You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and guest host Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I am your host, psychologist and marriage family therapist, Dr. Melody Fox. Cardoza is doing what he does best. He will be returning a couple weeks. He's out on assignment doing an international investigation, and we wish him well and great safety in bringing home whoever he needs to bring home. As each week, we bring to you guests that can inspire, educate, entertain here on Answers for the Family while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. With each of us having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, we have been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. As we bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week on Answers for the Family. Now, today, we are going to be talking with author Lenny Vessels about softening the blow. In regards to her new book, To Soften the Blow, she candidly discusses how to survive trauma through the telling of her own story. And our guest also has a master's degree in secondary education, has been teaching English in the public school system for more than 20 years, and she's also taught over 40 graduate education courses in the areas of communication and discipline, including, which I think is very important, teacher effectiveness training, self-esteem for educators, resolving conflicts in the classroom and schools, stress management for teachers, and researching today's students. She's also appeared as a guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show and has traveled the country as a very surprisingly candid motivational speaker, but I don't find that too surprising as her book is so candid. And Lynn, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much, Melody. Nice to be with you.
Well, I am so excited about having you here today, and I'm not sure what just happened there.
I founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis and expert services for locating runaway teens.
Somehow something got triggered, so stand by just a moment, please. There we go. All right. I think my paper hit a button, so excuse me for that. All right. So, Lenny, I have to say that I love the cover of your book, number one. It kind of captured me. It's just lovely, the design on it. But more importantly was the story. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the story, but I didn't want to introduce that and talk about it because I want you to talk about it as you do so eloquently. And I do want to say I have read autobiographies, biographies. I've always been interested in how people get to where they are from where they've been ever since I was a teenager. Uh-huh. And this is the first book I've never been able to put down. I had to read it from cover to cover. It was so eloquently written and so beautifully told. Your storytelling is just magnificent.
Thank you. Thank you.
And To Soften the Blow, which some people may not know what it's about, can you describe a little bit about what you wrote about?
Well, first of all, I appreciate you saying it was so candid, and I will tell you that if I had had a book like this to read when I was a child, a teenager, in my 20s, my 30s, I think my suffering from my own post-traumatic stress would have been a lot less, mm-hmm. because when I did step into therapy, it was the honesty that other people shared with me, the good, bad, and the ugly. I mean, I was determined to write a book that, you know, all humility aside, I was going to write a book that someone could take and use and get through this faster than myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly seems that way, and I think this is probably a must-read for any teenager and parent and educator. I mean, you discuss abuse, neglect, heartache, relationships, growth, healing, and, you know, moving forward in your life.
Well, I think the biggest part is the book starts with my actual first moments of my life when I was 7 years old. You know, I often thought for many years I could start a book that said my life began when I was 7 years old, mm-hmm. because I couldn't remember my life before that moment that I stepped out of the bathtub, to my mother screaming. I heard my mother screaming, and I was like, what's going on? And I opened the door, and my little sister and I had stepped out of the bathtub, and we walked into a pool full of warm blood. Our mother had just been shot with a 12-gauge shotgun at a 3-foot range across our dining room table by my father, who had gathered my 3 older brothers to watch. And of course, when the gun went off, they fled. But when I stepped out of the bathtub and came into the hallway, what I saw was my mother quivering on the hearth, and my 9-year-old sister standing in front of the barrel of the gun. My father was pointing it at my mother and into the face of my sister Mary, saying, get out of the way. I'm going to kill your mother. You kids are going to an orphanage, and I'm going to jail for 10 years. And my 9-year-old sister just jutted her chin right up the barrel of that gun, and with, you know, the meanest voice she could, she just screamed, no. And she would not get out of the way of that shotgun.
Was that Mary?
That's Mary.
Mary, your oldest sister. Then your younger sister was Judith, or Judy?
Judy, right. Judy.
Mm-hmm. What courage, you know, she took.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what courage she had to step up in the face of a barrel held by her father.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there are lots of phases you go through in life, but we often kind of have to laugh at, you know, some things. When you're a 9-year-old girl and you stand in front of a barrel of a gun like that, and she ultimately did have my father put that gun down and not kill my mother. But after that, Mary did not have fear about almost anything. She went on to create her own construction company in the outback of Australia, and she has been living there for about 33 years now and loves Australia and has a dynamic business. So she went and ran circles around people there and created a company.
But, you know, your book describes how you handled it or didn't handle the trauma, or how you move forward, or that initial shock.
Well, I had a professor pick up the book, and after he read it, he said he was changing his whole syllabus, and he was going to do a case study on Mary, Lenny, and Judy. And I already told you how Mary, you know, went and functioned. I stood there screaming for 30 minutes while Mary stood in front of the gun. And that really became a part of my life, becoming a victim and not knowing what to do in the face of, you know, great stress like that. Judy ultimately had her back toward me, or toward the event, and she was looking into my eyes. And Judy blocked out the entire event. I kept every picture, every word, every scream. I could block it out like a play, and which I did, you know, when I wrote the book. But I guess I want to say one of the most dramatic things that happened to me was, and really this, I've done a lot of healing over this for 25 years, but when I wrote the book, what really sunk in was the length of time that this ordeal lasted, that I was watching this. It lasted for about 20 to 30 minutes. And if you are a child standing literally naked in your mother's blood, and, you know, you're watching someone try to kill your mother, you really have to take yourself someplace, I think. And I was very fortunate to be able to have my little sister's eyes. The two of us were just screaming bloody murder, but we had, you know, little wispy blonde hair around our face and red, crinkly, wrinkly faces and green eyes that we were just staring into each other's eyes as we were screaming. And honestly, I do think that those moments are what solidified my life, because I was watching this horror and I kept looking into Judy's eyes. And I was watching this horror and I kept looking into Judy's eyes. And finally, the pain, I think, just became so great, I couldn't take it anymore. And I just had to go into this loving, peaceful place in my little sister's eyes. And I stayed there. And, you know, I think that's one of the most fascinating things about it, is that I was able to find a place not just of peace, but of joy while I was there. I mean, it's just an out-of-body experience. I really, really relate to people that have near-death experiences in that way.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And that's just the beginning of how mm-hmm. that incident affected your life. And you talk about the post-traumatic stress and the triggers that come up in different relationships and different areas of your life. But also I thought was very mm-hmm. poignant was how you had held a lot of the emotions inside, but then you were very angry for so long. And I work in middle schools and elementary schools and high schools. I see a lot of angry kids, and I've always felt the more explosive their anger, the deeper their pain is. And you right. talked about how there was no real comfort for you, no place to process, no place to talk about the trauma that you had just experienced.
Well, you know, if you look across history and you read, which I've done a lot of reading about violence and Martin Luther King and Gandhi and injustice, you will see that anger oftentimes is born from an injustice. And it wasn't just that my father shot my mother. It was the fact that everybody acted like it didn't happen. And that was the thing, I think, that made my anger just grow and grow and grow and grow. When people ask me, you know, what flavor ice cream do you want? I'd be thinking, are you kidding me? Really? Is this really what you think is important? I mean, even teachers, you know, they wanted me to work on math. I'd think, really? Is this really what you think is important? I mean, because I really got, you know, I came right out of the shooting, went back into the second grade. I had a very difficult time respecting adults because I didn't feel like any credence whatsoever was given to the fact that I had witnessed this. My brothers and sisters had witnessed this. And, you know, I grew up listening to, you know, you hear the local news all the time and they say, oh, you know, somebody was shot or somebody was stabbed. And they always say as an afterthought, and there were children present in the home, or the children were not present in the home, or the children were in some other part of the house, mm-hmm. which is what they said about us, but we weren't. I mean, you know, I always think of those children when an act of violence happens and think, you know, that they definitely need help.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many levels of violence that happens in a family. Physical,
yeah, there's
emotional.
That's very true.
And I would think by adults not talking about or providing you a space to talk about, that's almost abusive. That's more silent abuse.
Yeah, but, you know, that's, you know, people always say, well, that's the way it was back then. I mean, you know, I was giving a talk to teenagers one time, and somebody said, Ms. Bessels, what would you have wanted somebody to say? And I said, all I wanted somebody to say was, I know your father shot your mother. I mean, I just wanted somebody to acknowledge the fact that it had happened.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was all I wanted at the time. I just wanted, you know, I was constantly waiting for someone. And, you know, I was a child. I was waiting for adults to speak up.
It also made it more real. It wasn't a dream. It wasn't something that you might have imagined. Did you ever question it, or it was just...
Never. I never questioned it. I had everything with me, and it stayed with me every day of my life until I told the story. When I first told the story of the details when I was 27, 28 years old, that is the day that all of the pictures were released from me. And I truly believe in telling the details. Do you remember we heard stories of people coming home from World War II? Mm-hmm. Some people would talk about it. Some people wouldn't. Some people could heal from it. Some people couldn't. And they would be like, you know, in their 70s or 80s, and they still wouldn't have talked about war. My belief is that the healing is in the details. If we can find a safe person, I know people don't want to hear gruesome, but, you know, that is a very loving thing to do, to be able to hear, you know, the horrors that someone has gone through.
Right, and to acknowledge. And to also acknowledge that they came through that, too. They're still here.
Yes. I'll tell you what, I'm a teacher for 26 years now, and I've taught middle school for the last 18. And I will tell you one of the most effective things I can ever do is if I have any disruption from any child, which is so rare now because I'm, you know, have such a command, you get that after being a teacher for so long. But if I have any, if I see a child who's angry and it's not cooperating, I will take that person outside and I will look him in the eye, her in the eye, and I will just give her eye contact and I will say, "Hey, what's going on?" And the person will just look at me and shake and quiver, and I'll say, "Somebody's hurt you." And then all of a sudden, boom, I see these little tears come up. And I look at that person and I say, "I know someone has hurt you." If you think about it, somebody's hurt all of us.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody had just looked at me in the eye and said, "Somebody has hurt you terribly," I mean, really, that person can pinpoint it. I never have to know the details, but that person pinpoints it. And I look the person in the eye and I say, "You know what? I can see you're very angry. And my best guess is you have every reason to be."
Absolutely.
But right now, you know, your anger is coming out on me and the people in the classroom. And I just want you to see if you can be, you're able to contain that right now. Are you able to do that? And the person will generally say yes. I mean, that is the length of acknowledgement I have to give a child in order to get that child on my side.
Mm-hmm. And that child also knows that you are genuine and that you care. Because mm-hmm. that's what I found. Children know when you're not genuine.
Well, I've always said this, you know, since I've gone out and talked. I've been talking to teachers since 1993, I think I started. My big thing is kids are not bad. They are just in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it is my job to figure out what it is. I don't have to know all the details, but at least I have to be conscious enough to know that anger is born out of pain. And pain has to be healed and can be healed with love. It can't be healed with more anger or more angst given to a child or more stress. We just have to acknowledge that the child is in incredible pain. And I really did believe that when I first, you know, when I started to get my healing, all I needed was somebody to witness the pain that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want anybody to do anything for me. I just wanted people to understand that living with that, you know, I stored an enormous amount of pain.
Mm-hmm. I could only imagine. I know in your book you mentioned, you have quite a few wonderful quotes in there. One was mentioned regarding Scott Peck when he quoted from The Road Less Traveled. One that I particularly like when he described how he believed it was the most valuable a gift an adult could give a child was to let him see you walk through pain unmedicated without any drug of choice. And I think, you know, that is so poignant in that a lot of parents and adults don't role model for a child how to cope in loss. Like the adults around you after that tragedy never demonstrated how they coped.
Exactly. Well, you have a vast majority of people who cope with pain by grabbing something to medicate, mm-hmm. whether it be drugs or alcohol or, you know, TV or pornography or something. So that is one level of it. But the other thing is to just be able to sit in that kind of pain. You don't know this because we haven't chatted about this particular thing, but my brother Carl in the book,
uh-huh.
he actually died this past May.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
He was diagnosed, yeah. He was diagnosed with leukemia on 5 o'clock on a Wednesday night, and he died 36 hours later. And this was a horribly traumatic, you know, thing for me. Fortunately, Carl had read the book, and he liked the book, and he supported the book, and I knew that before he died, so that was a wonderful thing.
Uh-huh.
But I left school for 2 weeks, and when I came back, I told the kids, I said, "Look, you know, I'm different, you know, to me," I always say to people now that, you know, a sibling dying in your family is like an atomic bomb going off in your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I went back to school, and each day I sat down with the kids and I showed them pictures of my brother, and I said, this is what I did, and this is how, you know, I was in charge of being his administrator and cremating him, and I walked myself through that.
Mm-hmm.
And I modeled, you know, what it was like for somebody to have a sibling die.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that with everything that happens in my life. I make sure I incorporate it into the classroom.
Well, you definitely incorporated it into your book. I mean, you discuss so candidly the different relationships and the travels and the interactions and how that trauma would be triggered throughout your life until you came to soften the blow, so to speak. Now, you also talked about a significant person in your life when you were introduced to, in the midst of all your pain and your angst and your anger, when you were going into high school. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It was Mr. Huggins, my high school principal, associate principal. So funny, he just told me a couple years ago, he said that, you know, they were all sitting around together, a bunch of the principals. I had a school that was 7th through 12th grade. They were connected. And they were sitting around one day, and they said, hey, you know, we have this little girl we need you to look at. And so he was aware of me. And so one day, my principal, Jim Taylor, said to me one day, he said, hey, there's somebody I want you to meet. And at the end of my eighth grade year, he walked me across the courtyard to go meet Mr. Huggins. Now, I had been really in a lot of trouble all of seventh grade, but every single day of my eighth grade year, I had had detention in room 101 with Mr. Garrison. Mm-hmm. So I was what I call just sitting on a fence. I mean, I was developing, I was getting older, you know, there were sex and drugs around, I didn't know what to do, I was scared to death. It had been 7 years and I still had not spoken to anybody about all the angst I had inside me. And I felt like I was about ready to explode. And he walked me over there that day. And he said, Mr. Huggins, and Mr. Huggins came out and around, and he said, you know, here's a little girl I want you to meet. He said, I'm afraid if we don't do something with her, we're going to lose her. And my eyes just bugged up at what Mr. Taylor said, and I can honestly say it is the first true thing I ever heard an adult say. I was just stunned when he said that, right in front of me. I think that is one of the greatest things you can do for a kid. Mr. Huggins said, come on back. He took me back. He walked me behind the counter. You know, I go through all the details of everything he did to set up this place for me. He told the secretary to hold all calls. He went into the room. He, you know, showed me the seat. He turned the blinds down. He went around to his desk. He took the phone off the hook. Mm-hmm. And put his hands behind his head and just got very relaxed and looked at me just very calmly and said, what's wrong? Hmm. And in that moment, there I was with an adult, an older man in a room all by myself who had given me the illusion that he had so much time for me. And I just stared at him. I was petrified. I threw my head down and I cried for 20 minutes. I really did feel like, oh my gosh, I'm caught. You know, this was the explosion that needed to come out, but it came out in this way of crying. And after 20 minutes, I lifted my head, and there he was. He had moved slightly, but he hadn't left his seat or anything. And I lifted my head, and I said, my father shot my mom, and I'm mad. And I threw my head back down again, and I cried for another 10 minutes. And I always say the smartest move I ever saw somebody make was not a move at all. That man, he sat there in my convulsing, screaming, heaving, choking, crying. But this was the rock. This was the little rock that I had become. I just crumbled and broke. Mm-hmm. And when I lifted my head, he said to me, you know, that's all fair and good. I'd be mad too. Now, how are we going to educate you? And I'm thinking to myself, what are you talking about? Didn't you hear what I said? And it took me a long time to figure out that when you couple education with the feelings of a child and you let that child get those feelings out, that child is going to want to learn like crazy. One of the greatest things he ever said to me is he said, you have so much energy. And right now, all of your energy is going into negative things. And he jutted his hands out to the left. And then he goes, we need to figure out a way to take that energy, pull it back, shift it over, and channel it into positive things. And he literally put his hands out long, pulled them back, twisted, and threw his hands out again. And when I saw that physical depiction of these two channels, well, I said, well, that's defense right there. You know, I was felt like I was going to fall over on the negative side, but he was saying, we need to put you on this positive side. And I was like, okay. And I had heard when I got into therapy originally, I had heard, never ask a child what they think they should be doing, a dysfunctional child, because if they knew, they'd be doing it. Mm-hmm. You really have to lay it out for them and tell them and show them and instruct them, because, you know, I was a bright child, but I had many, many holes in my learning because I was so emotionally distraught, and that took up so much mental energy for me. But this man gave me a pencil and a spiral workbook and said, here, have at it, start writing. And I've been writing ever since.
And you write so beautifully. I just could gush about your book the whole time. And there's so many main points and themes in your book to soften the blow. Can you talk briefly about a few more that you'd like to let people know about?
Well, I think there's a wonderful saying that people use right now, and they say to children, they say, use words, find words. Well, I didn't have words. And that was, you know, I became a violent child. If somebody, you know, distressed me, I punched them. You know, I didn't have any words, and I didn't have any words for the teenage bully that I found in my school. I didn't have any words, and it was in therapy that I started to get words. Mm-hmm. I started to find words. I started to, you know, say I feel a certain way. I mean, you go into any AA meeting, which I'm not a member, but I was in Al-Anon for many, many years, and it's really the family disease of the feelings, learning how to say your feelings and learning how to say words. And I tell you, I have a book in me that is titled The Words I Never Heard from the Teacher I Never Had.
Wow.
You know, that is one of them. And I am that person. I mean, I feed my students with words. And when people walk into my classroom, they say, what's going on in here? Why are these kids like this? And I really do feel like I am teaching to a little Lenny that is a nervous wreck over there. I don't care who it is. I'm teaching to her, to everybody, and I am saying the words that I needed to hear from an adult. Mm-hmm. And I'm just being as real as I possibly can, and you can't even imagine how much humor comes with being real with 12-year-olds.
Well, fortunately, I can, and they are a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh, I guess you can. I'm sorry. I'm just, you know, I call them Pillsbury Doughboys because you feel like you just, you know, reach out and poke them, and they just giggle, giggle, giggle. But to match, you know, the awareness that they're getting with somebody who's telling them the truth about the world, mm-hmm. It is such a beautiful experience to be a teacher.
Mm-hmm. So what do you believe your overall message is into Soften the Blow?
Talk, 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 talk. Words, 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 words. Feel, feel, feel. Words, words, words. Just get it all out. And be around people that you can get it out with. You know, I'm going to try to figure out a way to take what's called the grief process. And, you know, it's the stage of shock and bargaining and anger and depression and denial. I am going to try to figure out a way to, for the consciousness of our society today, figure out a different way to call it, because Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did a great job with naming it the grief process or the stages or the responses to grief. Mm-hmm. But really, if you think about it, these are emotions that are everyday emotions. We lose things. We lose our car keys. We lose our homework. You know, we lose things. And we have what's called the grief process happen to us in an hour long or, you know, a month long or a year long. It happens. And it's really learning how to deal with emotions and having people not be so afraid of them. Because think about it. Most diseases, you know, and addictions people are reaching out for are because they are not able to bring a feeling forth and feel it all the way through. That's one big thing that I learned in therapy, that you're not going to die if you actually do experience and bring up, you know, pain from your past. But I really do think cultivating the emotional intelligence of children earlier in our lives helps them become better leaders, better friends, better family members. It just, like for one thing I say about the grief process is it is a train coming down a track. It is a biological function of the body. It is not something anyone can control. And it is normal and it is natural. I mean, if somebody had just told me, Lenny, being angry about what's happened is so normal. It's so natural. Like, I was in a fog for 4 years after the shooting. Lenny, it's natural to be in the state that you're in. I mean, if somebody had explained that to me, I don't know how I'm going to do that. I'm probably going to write a young adult novel or something that has that in there, you know, just really that can, you know, kids can hold on to. Because I tell you what, I teach it in my classroom now, and kids tell me it's one of the best things that they glean from the whole year.
Well, what a wonderful gift.
Yeah, I would like to do that. I mean, I didn't learn about it until I was 19 years old, the grief process. And I say, if I hadn't been so elated to learn about it, I would have thought it was, I would have just been so angry. You know, I just, you know, would have thought of it as a crime that it had been almost withheld from me. It was information that I needed. And I was not suicidal as a teenager, but there are a lot of people that are suicidal, and they don't know that they are going to get through the loss. They are going to get through it. You know, they can't feel it. Sometimes these people get cyberbullied and the humiliation is so great. They just don't know that they are going to get through it. And, you know, one of the things I keep saying these days is I truly believe that the conversation that we need to be having in our country is not about gun control necessarily, and not even about mental illness, but it is about emotional illness, and that the emotion of anger needs to be taught how to go through it. And first of all, to let people know it's natural, it's normal, it's okay, but, you know, how you deal with it and how you project it onto other people is not okay. You know, we just need to keep teaching kids about that so we don't have these shooting rampages. We don't have these people that are festering with anger and withdrawn or explosive or imploding or something like that. I mean, we need to just be really, really aware that people's emotions count.
Absolutely, they count. And I know our sponsor counts too, so we have to take a quick break. We are talking with Lenny Vessel, our guest today, who wrote the phenomenal book called To Soften the Blow. And we'll be back more with her in just a moment here on Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. call 1-800-899-8585. And let us help you.
And we're back with more Answers for the Family. I'm your host today, Dr. Melody Fox. Alan Cardoza is out on an international investigation. We'll be back in just a couple of weeks. Our guest today is Leni Vessel. She wrote an extraordinary book about her own life, about survival and recovery after trauma, severe trauma, called To Soften the Blow. And welcome back, Leni. I have a couple of questions, actually some guest questions and actually a comment. And the first one I'd like to share with you, it says, I've been a grief counselor in the San Diego school system for 20 plus years. Losing my son to cancer last summer triggered a depression in me that I never thought possible. After reading the review on the Answers for the Family website, I bought your book and could not put it down. I'm anxious to share it with my peers and those I'm working with, as it brings added dimensions and approaches to dealing with loss. So thank you for your great work, she says. Or he says.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
And then I have another listener question that came in. It says, my cousin returned from Afghanistan truly changed. He was on the ground in some of the worst areas and was part of the terrorist strike team. What was once an engaging, carefree young man is now a withdrawn individual who will hardly communicate with any of his family. How can we help him? Would your book give us, his immediate family, some direction? What are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have people in my life like that that I have dealt with. And I will tell this this listener, there is a book called Women Who Run with the Wolves. Mm-hmm. Go pick that up at the library. Women Who Run with the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes. She has two wonderful things in there. And one of them is the tale of the crescent moon bear. I retell it in my book because I live that tale, you know, in helping other angry people. But it is the most beautiful story. It's a metaphor of how to deal with an angry person who has come back from war. The woman's husband has come back from war. Beautiful, beautiful thing. And the other thing that book contains is four pages on forgiveness. They are the most remarkable words I have ever read. And every graduate course I taught, I sat down and I had teachers close their eyes, put their head down, lay on the floor, do whatever they wanted. But I read all four of those pages out loud to those teachers. It is one of the most phenomenal things about forgiveness. It was just beautiful.
Well, and that's something.
So, yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well,
I'm just going to say, so yes, you know, it is possible to bring that person back, but, you know, just it has to be done with so much love.
And absolutely a lot of love. And you mentioned forgiveness, and I responded to that because about in the book, there are many points in time where forgiveness came up. And that was very important, I think, mm-hmm. as part of your own recovery. And so what do you think it does take to heal from, say, PTSD or trauma?
What do I think? Well, I will say this about any person, you know, in any phase, like I was talking about, anything that happens to a person, forget my story. My story is extreme, but there are ones that are more extreme than mine. Take any loss, any trauma, any stress, anything that anybody has, and you're going to go through a process, you know, to get out of it. And I think what people do is they get stuck in anger. And that is so big. I mean, you know, when I'm teaching teenagers, I say, you know, this is the place where, you know, no teenager wants to say, wow, I'm depressed, or walk around, wow, I'm depressed. So they keep getting into the anger phase. They'll go and they'll drive their car 80 miles an hour, or they'll do drugs, or they'll have sex earlier than they wanted to. You know, just being depressed in our society is not kosher. But I'll tell you what, you're sitting down with somebody and they start talking about the fact that they're depressed or they have been depressed, and you see every eye look up at a dinner table. You're like, wow, you know, everybody, just allowing for people to be depressed and allowing for people to say their feelings and getting the courage and allowing for the courage of people, you know, to say these emotions. But I think my whole book actually, I had to heal my anger. I had a tremendous amount of anger. And I don't think my mother did a good job with modeling anger, because if you can believe this, you know, my mother never spoke one single solitary bad word about my father my entire life. And she always said, this is what alcoholism can do to a family. This is, you know, why we want to look at the disease of the family of alcoholism. So I didn't have that role modeled for me, so I really kind of, you know, followed her with the forgiveness part, but I was actually carrying a lot of rage that I had to then go in and look at the rage that I was carrying, because here's the thing. I say this in the book, that violence is silent. There are no words to it. You know, when you are picked up and moved, or this veteran that has been in, you know, this incredible tension, a lot of times there are no words said, and there aren't words you can put to that. But that violence, what it's really saying, if you look at the words that it's putting into your body, is you are worthless. You are nothing. You are able to be obliterated. You don't deserve to live on the planet. You know, we can, you know, in a heartbeat, get you out of here. You're nothing. You're nothing. You're nothing. You're nothing. And in my mind, and if you read the second part of my book, is really the reason I wrote that book, was to get that stuff down that I wrote on butcher paper, mm-hmm. is there are those negative thoughts that any of us, I mean, adopted kids, foster kids, angry kids, veterans, anybody who's carrying that anger, what you're really carrying, what I learned in bodywork therapy, is you're carrying ugly sentences. Hmm. And what I do in my book is I systematically go through the fact that I rolled out that butcher paper and I wrote down every ugly negative thought that I possibly ever could think of. And I actually purged that to the point where in the silence after all of my angst, you read it, you know, so you know, the crying and the screaming and the tears and the wailing. Mm-hmm. When I finally laid down, I heard a beautiful voice, and that beautiful voice came from my insides, and it said, I love you, you're beautiful, you're awesome, you're wonderful, you are a beautiful, precious child of God. This other stuff is nothing. It has nothing to do with you. It is not you. You know, you can just, you're free of it. And really, it is enormously, it takes an enormous commitment to go down and really look at that ugly, ugly, ugly stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's also about finding your inner voice, the true voice.
Say it again.
I think it's about finding your voice, your true voice, that inner person that you are, not what everybody else has told you, but what you are.
You know, that's the place where I always tell my students, I say, you know, that sweet, sweet place when you're cuddled up, you can have so much horror going on in your life. But when you curl up at bed at night and you lay your head down on your pillow, you know, and you see that person, you know, and you get to talk to that person, and that sweet, sweet place that you can find, you know, that is, you know, that is where you are going to hear your inner voice. I also tell them that whenever they're experiencing joy and laughter, which is generally with their best friends, and I also teach kids that their best friend changes all the time, mm-hmm. but the person that you are experiencing laughter with, and you get stitches in your stomach, they get your jokes, you get theirs, I always say to my students, that is who you really are. That is you. That is the way you are meant to experience life. Mm-hmm. This other stuff, when you get depressed or stressed or overwhelmed, that's not you. You know, but that's why you have friends and family to bring you back, to show you who you really are. You know, so I think managing stress, you know, the stress you have in present time, and if you have something like this to heal, you know, you really have to be so gentle with yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to be around very gentle people.
That does make sense. And a lot of times we aren't born into a family of gentle people. So we have to find those people and bring
exactly.
them into ourselves. And you were talking about being being gentle, does that have anything to do with your title, to soften the blow, to soften, to be gentle? How'd you come up with that title?
Well, I think I before I wrote the book, it seemed like for probably 15 years, I walked around in my head saying, you know, Sonny, you know, I didn't even hear the gun go off. You know, I mean, all I heard was my mother screaming, and my head was literally 4 or 5 feet from the gun blast and a wall, and the bathtub started. I was there. I think I was underwater. But I did not even hear the gun go off, you know, which is, to me, I'm thinking, wow, I didn't hear the gun go off, but every single thing I have done in my entire life has been to soften the blow that it shattered my family. It shattered my family. It scattered my family. You know, and I really do feel just incredibly blessed that I was able to feel the spiritual feelings of, you know, being able to go to another place. I was able to watch my sisters the same words that had my father put that gun down. I mean, he was bent on killing my mother. He was going to do it. He was determined to do it. And I got to see a 9-year-old child say words to a man that brought him out of that place. You know, when I think about the gifts I was given on that night, I feel very, very fortunate. And I feel like, you know, I really knew, I've known ever since I was a young child that being able to feel that joy in the midst of so much horror, I just had to be able to talk to people about, you know, that's what I do on a regular basis. I tell my students, you know, you have two voices and you have two choices. Every moment of every day, you are going to have a negative voice about the same situation. You have a positive voice. You've got one situation, a negative voice, and a positive voice. You get to choose. Every single time you get to choose, every minute all along the day, you get to constantly choose. Yes, you could be wrong. Somebody could really be a jerk, but you are walking away from it and you are deciding how you're going to think and feel. I mean, I feel like I was given that when I was in the midst of the shooting. I got to make a conscious choice, and I did. I decided, I like Judy's eyes. I like this peace I feel. I like this love I feel. And when I went to Mr. Huggins later, I got another dramatic lesson. He says, you know, you can put your energy here or you can put your energy here. And I was like, okay, I pick there. I pick there. Mm-hmm. Teach me. Show me. You know, just show me. And I say this all the time to people with kids and teachers is I could don't for about 3 minutes. If somebody said, Lenny, don't do that, I would put my hands on my thighs. I would just sit there and I would don't. I'd be like, Lenny, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. And 5 minutes later, I'd be up to it again because I did not know what to replace it with. People didn't, and I tell people this to this day, I show my students where to put their pinky finger. I laugh. I say, okay, I want you all seated, crisscross. I want your knees 2 inches apart. I want you, you know, with your back straight up. I want you with a pencil and paper in hand. I mean, I tell them exactly what I want so that the little Lenny in class that doesn't know what to do, she knows what to do. Because she's been given instructions. Mm-hmm. I mean, instructions with kindness and firmness. You put those things together and you have a child in the palm of your hand.
And that is so true. And you know, leading children or even adults sometimes people need to be kind of taken by the hand and told, let's step through here, let's sit here, let's tell me about this. And just giving that undivided attention and giving them guidance and guidelines and directions because people don't know. I mean, I'm really big believer that nobody knows what you think or what you feel or what you perceive. And everybody's just responding to what's going on with them. And if you're trying to navigate yourself in the world but don't know how to do that, you need direction. Mm-hmm.
I will say to people that there are places that will give a human support all over the country, all over the world, in 12-step meetings and support groups that you can find in libraries, you can find in churches, and they're free. They are just, I can't believe the services that are available to people for free, for teenagers. I mean, for free, you can go and you can have people keep your confidentiality. You can talk openly and freely. You can heal yourself for free if you're willing to take the time and commitment.
And they take you step by step by step. But I have to say, unfortunately, we are out of time here, but I really want to encourage people to go get your book. It is so lovely and so beautifully written, and you're an extraordinary person. And thank you for sharing and being so candid in your book and coming on the air today with us. And if people are interested in your book or getting a hold of you, how may they find you?
Well, I'm at LennyVessels.com. LennyVessels. That's my website. And I'm on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. All you have to do is look up To Soften the Blow. And my book is available electronically. It's on the shelves at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at print off my website or Amazon. And I just really want to get this book into the hands of every educator in the world. That's my goal. I've been told it has a very long shelf life, and I really want it to be used as textbooks for people. I thank you so much, Melody.
Well, you are so welcome. I can tell you, I will be taking it back to the school where I work as well. So thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to your next book when it comes out.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. And we'll be back with more Answers of the Family next week, right here, same time, same channel. Take care.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and guest host Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.